As much as I like to fight everyone, I'm having a pretty good time here. Why you mad? Why you mad? Why you mad?
All right. Hey, Louisa. We're back.
Hi, Jake. How you doing?
Good. How was your Why You Mad vacation that we took inadvertently?
I know. It was a pretty good little week off, right? Well, it ends up being 2 weeks off, right? Nice. Yeah, between episodes. That's pretty great. Yeah. It's been good. Because, you know, I told you last time I was, like, adjusting to meds, going through some shit. So, still kind of sleepy from meds, but doing all right. Just working, riding my little stationary bike. I did 10 miles today. Generally looking forward to, because I told you I got vaccinated, right?
Yeah.
So I get my last shot soon. So I'm already like enjoying life. I'm going to go to a show today outside. It's like warm out. So there's comedy.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm doing pretty well. But then I look at Twitter and I immediately feel bad. And I swear it didn't used to be like that, you know? So I'm wondering if, like, when you have a healthy brain, you look at Twitter and you recognize it's bad.
I don't know. I kind of think that's true because, like, I've been exercising too because I got, like, you know, what happened is they were like, you can get vaccinated if you weigh this much. And I had to check. And then I was like, oh, shit, I can. And then I was like, I should exercise after I get the fucking vaccine because I shouldn't weigh as much. So I got a stair stepper. That's my shit. I have a projector in the fucking in the loft, you know? And so I throw on a fucking like movie and then I put like Wi-Fi little Bluetooth headphones on. So I can just do this all night. Without making any noise, just sit there and stair step and then just watch, like, I watched, like, Spirited Away, that Miyazaki film the other night. It was great.
Yeah.
Just stair step for 2 hours. It's pretty good.
That's good. You've been watching good stuff. I was watching Criminal Minds. Rewatching, thank you very much, which is funny because at work I like did a Zoom and you could tell that the screen was paused on Criminal Minds and like three different like Zoomer PAs DM'd me on Slack to be like, are you watching Criminal Minds? That show rules. And I'm like, I'm gonna be cool until I die. This is so funny. Young people love me, I love them. Word up to you guys and your lifestyle and your groovy hairs. You're doing great.
Oh, have you seen the like the Zoomer millennial controversy? Like,
I think it's so funny. I fucking love it.
It's as a
Zennial,
so
which I guess is kind of like a Gen Xer right now. I'm being like, oh, that is so funny. That is so cute. Have you actually seen the Gen X memes about this?
No.
There's like a really good one. Fuck, it's from what movie? It's Kevin Nealon. And I forget what it is, but it's like Kevin Nealon and he's labeled as Gen X. And then there's like a younger kid and he's labeled as Gen Z. And Gen X walks up to Gen Z and is like, hey, what's up? And Gen Z is like, what the fuck? Get out of here, you fucking old guy. And Gen X responds, yeah, man, way cool, down with the fucking man. And I'm like, yes, exactly. I fucking love it.
I love really those great fucking memes, man, because I mean, I don't know, they're just, they're so true. And like millennial, I'm, you know, like smack kind of in the millennial generation. And I've like, and I guess for also from being a comic, you're like so in touch with pop culture and stuff all the time that like, it's been really fascinating to me to live through like the era of the PBR beard flannel shirt guy Modest Mouse shit being like what rules society to slowly watching like young adults come up and go like, you know, fucking old man about that shit, and watching my friends like become old and fight it and go like, no, it's cool. And it's like, no, it's not. This happens to everyone, man. As soon as you have these identifiable character traits that like they just gel, like the fucking side part on the hair thing. I never thought about that. That's such a fucking millennial thing. It's so weird. We used to all call each other hipster Hitler for getting that fucking haircut, you know?
Well, I'm not gonna change it. I'll say that much. I think one of the great things, if you get old with dignity, well, maybe it's not dignity, because maybe people think with dignity is like dressing your age, right?
Yeah.
But I think if you get dressed, I mean, get old genuinely, I guess, you get to the point where there's stuff that you like and you don't give a fuck who thinks what about it. And you're going to wear these kinds of pants until forever. And that's how you are, right? what really makes you a stupid old person is if you then like turn around and you're like mad at other people's pants and hair. Like, yeah, who gives a shit? What are you doing, dude? What are you doing? You're literally your grandma right now. What are you doing?
Yeah, no, dude, there's a lot of millennial cane shaking happening right now. And it's,
yeah, it's
like,
super funny. As a spectator, I'm enjoying it. And here's the thing. So I have tweeted a few things about generation stuff in the last few weeks. And it's so funny, the fucking responses that you get. Like, well, there's a couple of things about it. But one is this response of like, oh, Generation Wars is like a made up cultural fucking thing to divide the working classes, whatever.
Yeah, that's not true.
No, it's not true. And it's super funny, though, because to me, like, look at me. I enjoy talking about this generational thing. I'm an anthropologist. I think it's super funny to like define groups by their observable behavior and characteristics. And even though it's problematic, right? That's the whole fucking thing. But to me, it's like my astrology, you know, like it is even more real than astrology, but it is something that it's like you can identify or not identify with it. You could see the characteristics of you belonging in this group or not belonging in this group. And then you can use that information however you want to use that information, whether it's to assimilate to the group or to place yourself in opposition to them or whatever it may be, or disregard it completely. So I just think it's super funny because it's like being a Zennial is like being the best sign, to be honest with you. I'm like, this is great. I'm like, both sides like me. I'm not really the bad guy. I just didn't really do anything to fix anything. Like, I don't know. It's pretty funny to watch it happening. Plus, also, it's just like the aging thing, and I've heard older comics speaking about this, you know, how like obviously there's like premises that continue, they persist throughout time. So you see like the wave of comics who are all starting to get married or all starting to have children or all starting to have problems with their bodies, you know, and like all starting to quit drinking, all, and like they all go through these fucking phases, and one of them is how they deal with aging. And the entire premise of like a 29-year-old being like, I'm old, you know, like, oh my God, yeah, I'm so old. I don't know what's funnier to me, to see those jokes from a 29-year-old or to see like an older person being mad at those jokes. I'm like, you're both so fucking stupid. Like, I'm like, what the fuck is even happening in your minds? It's just super funny. So I just keep watching these like cycles. So then like the person who this year is complaining about being 29 and that's their Twitter persona, you know,
in
5 years it's gonna be how they can't wait to have a baby or how they just had a baby. You know, like, it's like you're just gonna go through all these fucking things.
No, it's like stages of grief or something for your own fucking self. You know, it's weird, I had a bit that was about exactly what you just said like a year ago when I was doing stand-up, like up until, you know, a week, about how astrology is dumb, but then like the generation thing is just the same principle, just, you know, taking fucking 20 years at a time or whatever. I don't remember what the joke was, though. It's weird. I'm thinking about this was in my material the last time I did stand up, and I don't fucking remember what the beats were at all. That's something to do with eating ass.
It's timely now, so you should work on it again, because the other response that I got from dudes, obviously, was that, that it's like pseudoscience, right? Because like depending on the region and your class and, you know, there's all these like variant cultural factors that means like maybe you didn't drink this soda and you drank this other soda. And it's like, yeah, obviously, you fucking idiots. I feel like you don't understand the concept of like defining a group or like defining a word even. When you say that something is defined by X, Y, and Z, it doesn't mean nothing else on earth also experiences Z. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
What are you fucking talking about? So when you say that like a particular people, and most of the time that I speak about it and I say in the West or I say in America, you know, I'm very specific to not say that I think a Zennial can be applied in India or in Japan. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Or you could use the word, but their defining characteristics would be different, you know? So here in America, yes, there are variations by class, by region, because this fucking country is so big, and by culture, by being like whether you're part of a subgroup like Latinos or Arabs or whatever, right? But you can start to define the group by narrowing down those observations to saying the people in America, the people in the West Coast, you know what I mean? Like, with each observation, that's how you define something, you fucking dummies. And when you can make like a loose, especially when this is so fun, I think it's so fun when so many people around you are like freaking out about aging and fighting amongst each other based on these like generational ideas, and then they get mad that they get put in a group. I think it's so super funny.
Yeah.
So that was actually a good part of my week. Thank you for bringing it up.
Did I bring it up? I don't even remember.
Yeah, I think you did. I don't know. I'm going to blame you for that one. But look out for the fun stuff there. That should be... I look forward to your bit. I want to hear more about generations.
Well, so I've been writing because, like, you know, I think one of the reasons, and I'm going to fucking brag here when I say this, is like... One of the reasons I didn't freak that much out over COVID is, first of all, it's because I'm a lifer, like with comedy, and like a lot of other people are not, and they have this deal they made in their head, but they're like, if I don't make it in 6 months or whatever, then
I'm out.
Then I'm out. And so this throws a huge fucking stopper in that, and you kind of bums you out because you're like, oh, I might just have to quit now. But I'm a lifer because I don't care. Like, I like comedy and I'll just do it whether it's fucking my main job or not, which will probably switch back and forth, you know?
Yeah.
And the other thing is I got good enough to where I can just write. Like, I don't have to grind mics and shit. So, like, I've been writing material. Like, while watching stand-up and stuff and, like, doing the stair-stepper in my fucking room, I got material. Fucking book me on a show as soon as it's safe. And I'll have, like, I think I got, like, 10 minutes, you know, just worked out in my head that I can just... do a few times on stage and probably kick the tires on shit. So, like, I feel fucking good, man.
Yeah, man. You know, I think most people who probably listen to this podcast are aware about Maria Bamford and how she has been doing weird stand-up for years now at this point, I think. You're aware of that, right? No?
What do you mean?
Like, even before the pandemic, right?
She did, Marie, like, a whole special just in front of her parents and shit like that.
Right, but so that special came out of the fact that she, like, when she was on the road and shit, going, like, theater to theater and, like, big show to big show, she didn't, like, unless she's in New York or L.A., there's no, like, smaller shows and stuff to work out at, and she needed to write material and work things out.
Yeah.
So... she started doing this thing where she would go on Twitter and just be like, I'm in this area. Who wants to sit in front of me so I could do 30 minutes of stand-up to you? I'll buy you a coffee and a pastry.
That's funny.
And she would just like answer to a random, you know, and pick this person and tell them what coffee shop to meet her at. And then she fucking would sit there in front of them and just do her 30 minutes of stand-up and then, like, buy that person a pastry and thank them and then go off. And that's how she built up the material for that special where she did the thing with her parents and then also how she continues to work. And so since the pandemic, she's continued to do that, like, on Zooms. And she does Zoom comedy shows, you know? Like, she very quickly, I would say, adapted to it. And she does, like, headliner Zoom shows. And, like, Jackie Cation opens for her. She's had other people. And she, like, smoothly went into this. And I think that, like, before the pandemic, it seemed like, oh, like, a weird, quirky thing that Maria's doing because she's weird and quirky and whatever. But I very much think, especially now, after we saw how comics reacted after the pandemic, or during, I guess, I think that she found herself with limitations, both like, oh, I'm on the road and I can't find actual stage time to work out, and things like her mental health issues that made her uncomfortable going out to meet people and going to strange shows and, you know, trying to get stage time in the other, like, other ways, right?
Yeah.
And instead of that saying to her, well, that means I have to quit, it said to her, well, I have to figure out a way that it'll work for me, right? And she figured out a way. And so then it just happened to be that when this pandemic happened, she already had developed some of these, like, how do I work out in front of just one person or in front of just five faces on a screen or, you know? And I think it's partially what you're saying, that this comics, I think...
they're fucking dorks. They subscribe to like it's like a dojo, like a doctrinaire set of rules and stuff.
Like, they need to get the belts in a certain schedule and stuff. And it's like,
you are the person stopping you from getting ahead. I sound like a fucking self-help guy or a business guy when I talk about this or something. But, you know, I mean, I don't know, a big fucking commie or whatever, but there's an aspect to this where it's like, I'm good at capitalism because I understand capitalism because I hate capitalism. And I am still an entrepreneur. So, like, I am yelling at young comedians, like, you are the only person standing in your own way, you know, like, you don't have to be doing this. And part of that is I guess might as well segue into this, like, with the club stuff. And, oh, like, the fucking club.
I almost forgot because I medicated myself and I stopped being on Twitter so much. But, yeah, it's terrible. Sorry, go on.
You were talking about medication. Yeah, I mean, no. Just to go back to that for a second, it's like, okay, yeah, I do feel better. Like, you can notice when your brain feels better. But I think Twitter's still uniquely kind of evil.
Good.
Like,
evil?
Yeah. Because I've been doing all this stuff to make myself feel better right now, because I know that's how it works. Like, somatic or whatever is the word. Like, you make your body feel better, and all of a sudden your point of view changes in these ways that you thought intellectually were, you know, like, everything was logically a certain way or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, same. I think Twitter is like the opposite of exercise. It's the opposite of somatic. It's like a thing that your brain does that makes your body feel bad.
Yeah.
But anyway, the check spot thing, let's talk about that.
Oh yeah. That also came off Twitter. Which, as you were saying that, I think the problem is that, tweeting feels good. And getting likes feels good, and retweets. And, like, literally, you get serotonin hits and shit, right?
Yeah.
But fucking replies could go either way 90% of the time are bad.
Do you make your heart race? Every morning, when I check my phone, I'm like, I have this immediate, like, it breaks me from the amnesia for a second, where I go, what the fuck am I doing? And then I look through the replies, and the whole time, I have this vague feeling like it's going to go one way or the other.
It's going to go, and you're like, the shoe's going to drop. I'm either going to hear the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me, or yet another mean thing today. Thanks. Great. Or something like intellectually frustrating or fucking disrespectful as a woman. Like, oh, it's just fucking, it's terrible. And I don't know. Like, it seems at this point, like, we're just probably all addicted to it and shit. But I do think it has positive. I mean, we've talked about this before, but part. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well,
maybe this text spot conversation is part of like an example of what Twitter can be good for.
The thing is, I mean, like, I think I've kind of touched on this before, and I also did something recently on PDA that kind of touched on it. But I really am kind of stuck on it because, like, we just did an episode on PDA about these, like Second Life, like those types of video games, like social chat room video games. And somebody like a fucking, what do you call them? An archivist came on the show and was talking about how they took on this project of archiving old spaces like that. So the show is called Preserving Worlds. It's on Means TV. It's a pretty interesting concept, right? And in it, though, they interviewed all these people and, like, you know, they were sort of asking them, like, what did you get out of being on Second Life? And, like, what did you get out of, like, you know, why'd you spend so much time on this fucking virtual world online or whatever? And the thing that always kind of sticks with me when I listen to this stuff is, like, there's a lot of, like, trans people and stuff like that that get really into this sort of stuff. And I think that the math on that, like, the reason for it is, like, that. And I'm saying this as someone who I have a lot of anxiety. Like, I do stand up because, like, it's allows me to control social situations. Like, it's very pleasing for me. That's why I got into it. Yeah. Like, I have thoughts. I go to a party. I start talking. I'm like a paragraph talker. It's fucking frustrating. No one listens to you, but you go do stand up and they have to listen to you, right? And so, like, you know, there's all sorts of autism in my family and shit. Like, there's something going on here, right?
Yeah.
So there's.
I will say, I think that's why a lot of comics like it, is because they can control the social interaction and be listened to.
Yeah. And they're all autistic.
Yeah.
Like, we're all on the spectrum.
I wasn't going to say that, but maybe.
I'm a, like, big everyone is on the spectrum person, but that's a whole other podcast, right?
Yeah.
So, anyway, all these people who I think that, like, what they had was this thing that's described. There's this book called Neurotribes. It's about autism, and it's about how, like, when CB radio first came out, all these fucking people immediately formed a subculture on it. It was because they weren't getting what they needed to get out of life by, like, going out and going into the organic institutions that we've created to just mill about and meet people, because there's something that only the technology allowed you to, like, really fully express yourself in. And I think that's a major component of what's going on with social media, because there's just so many people that are just, like, a fucking, they're not the person who they are in real life when you see them, or on the internet when you see them in real life or whatever. And I think that it's like a double-edged sword, right? Because, like, in a lot of ways, like, take, for example, like a trans person who can't express themselves, like, that's good. Like, it's fucking, you know, wholesome. Like, it means, like, you can...
You mean that it's good that they can express themselves on Twitter?
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah.
Not that they can't.
No. The internet being, like, a place where you can exist is really good. And I think that's, like, invaluable. And I feel a little bit like that. Like, I'm, like, a little bit, like... I'm glad the internet exists because there's part of my brain that, like, the fucking format of it just works a lot better. And I feel like I often get everyone tells me I'm, like, too online or whatever, but that's kind of, like, why, you know, except, like, social anxiety and stuff like that. But on the other hand, it's like almost like when you are presented with the internet, there's, like, a fucking fork in the road, and it's like, will you use this aspect of it to, you know, for the good part of your soul or the evil one, you know? Yeah. And a lot of people are like, this is where I get to go be aggressive and hateful in all these ways that society won't allow me. But that's what society's for, is to, like, keep that sort of stuff from, like, happening, you know? So I don't know, man.
Well, I think I've talked to you about this one time that we talked about Finstas, right?
Yeah.
Because it goes for me all the way back to the problem with modernity, right? And that... long ago, this, like, separation of public and private space that happened during the Enlightenment. Stay with me. This connects to Twitter. During the Enlightenment, basically the resolution to the Hundred Years' War was to create the idea of a citizen and divide the world into public and private spheres. Before the Enlightenment, there was no such enlightenment. And I don't say that word good. But you get it. Before then, there was not really that. You know, there weren't private spaces. People didn't have an expectation of privacy. People did not have an interior life other than in relation to religion, right, as far as documented, let's say. So after the Enlightenment, the way that they decided to fix the Hundred Years' War, which was a religious war, was to create this idea of a private sphere in which you could be whatever type of individual you want to be. You can believe whatever you want in private, but then in public, you have to be a sovereign subject of your king, right? Of your land, which means that in public, you behave the way that you're supposed to behave. You follow the laws of the land. You dress the way that you're supposed to. You're a fucking good citizen, right? And then in private, that's what gave rise to sadomasochism, fucking cult, like all this fucking shit, because it was the first time ever that intellectually humans were told. And, you know, as this wave of ideas spread out of points from the Enlightenment, more and more people around the world were being told, as long as you do what you're supposed to do on the outside, you could do whatever you want privately.
Oh, so it's like compartmentalized into the... all the stuff you can't express.
Exactly. And it's what created a schism within us, Jake.
Yeah.
Because before that, it really wasn't that. You were a peasant and you did what you were born to do, and your happiness was in, like, time with your family and eating something delicious and fucking a wench, you know, like having a beer. And now we have all these fucking, like, problems with our individuality and our goals and our fucking expectations of privacy and all of this stuff that is rooted in this very practical political resolution on how to deal with a religious war, right? And, you know, it was the beginning of trying to make it was literally the beginning of the idea of a secular society, right? Which would then compartmentalize interior life into private sphere.
Yeah.
And to me, the idea of a Finsta bothers me, because I think that what it does is continue that trend, continue to exacerbate that schism, where it tells people you should have a public persona, whatever they think that is, and then also have this private space where you could be more risque, where you could be your real self, where only the people that you truly trust will see. And it encourages this idea that you could be these two different people, right? And that you could be a good person in one place and be a daring, you know, fucking provocateur in the other. And I think that Twitter is the same thing for all of us, even if you only have one account, right? Like, I was thinking about the what I've been calling the hierarchy of accounts in my head, which is, like, at the top, we have the fucking check marks, like you, Jake, right? You're a check mark, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God. So at the top, we have the check marks, who are people who use their real name and their real face, and they have been verified by Twitter. And usually it's like, you're famous or you were a big account when they first started this program. So either way, it's they verify that you're who you say you are, right? Then in the middle are all the people with long-standing accounts who use their real face and use their real name, but they are not verified. And usually that's like that's the biggest group, and it contains a lot of the professionals, right, who use media as a professional, but also do it as a, I am a professional, but then their bio says none of this reflects my employer.
Yeah.
And then the last tier, the unimportant tier, is the people who don't use their face or their name on their one account. And they all have a reason, right? It's always like my job, you know, the things that I like, I'm scared might get me fired. I don't want my family to find my Twitter and see my humor, you know, all these things that literally what they're saying is like, I want that mask of like, I am who I am in the public world, but I need this space where I can say slurs, where I can retweet porn, where I can fucking say mean shit to women because I don't like their jokes, like be a piece of shit to fucking, I don't know, celebrities, whatever. And it seems like there's like even a further duality because it's like the duality of our mask, right? Of our who we really are and who we're projecting on Twitter. And then there's also the inverted relationship with others, I think. Because in real life, you are like, like how to put it? Or I guess on Twitter, the relationship that you have with others is like more transactional, right? It's more like a direct video game ping of serotonin where you like each other's tweets, you follow back, you fucking retweet each other, you build your networks in this way of it being like a one-for-one transactional nature to relationships. And then we go outside in the real world where we're not projecting that same thing in a lot of cases, and we're confused that our relationships are not resulting in the same transactions. You know what I mean? Like, it's definitely like a different way of socializing, but the fact that we have already confused ourselves with like who I really am in private and who I am in public has also led to the secondary problem of how do you have relationships with others then if you've learned them in these not genuine ways? I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's complicated because like, yeah, I think that one reason comedians like hated Twitter when it came up is because comedy itself is a bullshit hierarchy that everybody is gaming and trying to get ahead in. And then like Twitter is the same thing, but it runs differently. So it was incongruent. Like people would be like, what? This open micer is a blue check. Well, you know, I don't want to treat them like they're better than me in public. Yeah. And it's like, well, this shouldn't be happening either in either direction anytime, but you were just mad because you were enjoying it happening in a way that benefited you first. And now you're like pissed off because it got fucking flipped around. Right. What does that teach you? Fucking none of this stuff should be happening. Right. But there's also like this aspect where like, yeah, I mean like comedy is, I was talking about this with a friend of mine the other night. Like I think what's happening with social media is like, especially with these incongruencies that are freaking people out, like the cancel culture thing. I know we all fucking talk about every episode or whatever, but like people are suddenly like famous. Like everybody's kind of trying to get famous on social media, and suddenly they're having this problem where like there's like, you know, you can't make a joke because people, some people in the audience will react. And I say the audience, it's your followers on Twitter or whatever. And I was thinking about this the other day because like somebody got in trouble for a fucking racist, you know, ironic tweet or whatever. And like people are arguing like, you know, is it okay? Is it not okay? And I'm sitting here and I'm going, as a comedian, I'm telling you, this is a subjective situation. Like everyone who says that racist jokes are objectively wrong is an asshole. And everyone who says that they're objectively right is an asshole. Like the factor is like consent. Like, you can say all the worst slurs in private with your friend or your coworkers or whatever, who you formed a bond with, who, you know, the deal is that you get to socially transgress and cross a line together. And that's what's so funny, is that you're doing it together and you're sharing a moment, right? But when you do it in public and you don't have control over who hears it, then, you know, you can still do it, but you're running a risk that someone out there will hear it, have a genuine ill response to it and then respond to you. And that is exactly what it has been like to be a comedian for 20 fucking million years, right? So I think that's why I was, like, better prepared for social media than a lot of people was, because, like, I've been doing this forever and I have it hammered into my head that, like, every time I do stand up, I'm like, there's a room of people out there. I don't know who they are. I have to figure out where the fucking line is, because if I'm not offensive enough, if I don't transgress enough, I'm not funny. And if I do it too much, I'm an asshole and I'm just going to piss these people off and lose them. So that's the fucking game. And a lot of times it ends with me at the end of the night going, God damn it. Fuck, I pissed that motherfucker off. Like, people hate you at the end of the night all the time when you're a comedian. So you have a little, you should have a little bit better of a, if you're a good comic, I think you should have a better skill for this. But a lot of people who do comedy aren't good at this. Yeah. So, like, they just do what they do. And so they come away, you know, with essentially what a comic thinks like after a bad set, which is where they kid themselves into thinking it's the audience's fault. It's not my fault, right?
Well, okay, but they're right. You're right. Oh my God. Do you see how this is all part of that? Now I'm the burpy one. Part of that public-private schism problem, because in reality, one of the reasons that comics are, like, let's say, having the problem of, like, I used to make race jokes and everybody loved it, and now I, like, the Nick DiPaolo's, right? And now I do it and people get fucking mad at me. Yeah, it's, the problem is you're old and times changed and whatever the fuck. But it's not like any of that shit was okay to say before anyway. You know what I mean? So it's not that it's that. It's literally a private public problem, right? Which is, what you just said was, you're allowed to say whatever you want in a space that where consent is present, where the people like you or who agreed to be in that group with you have that kind of language. So you guys, let's say racial slurs. But in public, you have to behave X way because the public now doesn't accept this kind of language, right? But the real problem for comics and for a lot of men and other, I say men specifically, but like for a lot of people, honestly, is that before, the public space was a, especially in stand-up, was a white male-dominated space. You understand me?
Yeah.
So part of the reason they were successful is that they got to say the same things they said in private, in public, because they were in a room of consent, because they were in a room where they were powerful, and they were, on top of that, we're going to talk about the Patrice documentary, but look at how they said that he was, it's the power of being an original thinker, the power of stepping outside and saying something. Really, what he was saying is things you say in private, things that Patrice said in front of his family, things that Patrice said in front of only Black people. Then he brought it to public spaces. That's what made him different and original, right?
Yeah.
So what happens now to a lot of comics is they go outside of their private cellar space or wherever the fuck, and they go and they make some racist joke. It happened to Giannis. Just yesterday, I'll just say, like, last night he tweeted something fucking stupid. It comes out, it's racist. It's not funny. And the problem is, I'm sure that a lot of his fan base is into it. It had a lot of retweets and likes and all the shit. And then it also had a lot of Black people mad at him, including comics, because they're like, what the fuck, dude? You really thought this is like the thing to tweet? You know what I mean? And what happened there is that his private and public were pretty close always. He got to say whatever he wanted in both spaces. And then in recent years, his public has expanded, partially because of things like Twitter, to include people who weren't always in on the consent of, we think this is funny.
Right.
And now that escapes, and he feels like he's the one being violated because his public space before allowed this speech. But the reality is that the public space continues to change, especially as it increases access to people who were not previously allowed to speak publicly.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And like, I was explaining this to somebody because, okay, so like there's some fucking Twitter account on like the dirtbag left that got in trouble for ironic racist fucking meme or whatever. I don't know. Didn't really pay much attention to it. I was just paying attention to the meta discourse afterwards. And like, what I noticed is that like fucking, the dirt bag left thing, like the fucking online Twitter left thing, it's crazy. Every single person that is on one side of the argument is white, and every single person that's on the other is, well, not every single person, but everyone who's like a person of color is on the other. And it's like, you won't fucking listen, because the thing you don't understand, I think, especially if you're white, when it comes to this racist stuff, is exactly what you're saying, which is that like, like what I was saying about consent, it's complicated because it's like when people used to say all these fucking slurs and stuff in public and nothing happened, there was no feedback to them, it's not that no one heard that stuff and was offended, it's that those people didn't have a voice. So your experience as a white person is that everything is okay, because exactly. what you're doing is you're fucking hurting people around you all the time, but that's what privilege is like not knowing that your actions are having consequences and never yeah. having to address that. And so you, I mean, you honest, like you could be honest and say, what, everything's fine. Cause you have no way of fucking knowing. And then all that happened is that nothing changed except for those people's ability to give you feedback now. But what that is reading like to the person in a, like a point of privilege is like, I mean, you could tell it's just classic. It's so fucking stupid. It's the same way it always happens, is that they're going, there must be a cultural phenomenon. It, like, cancel culture. You always hear this word culture. Yeah. That's not a fucking Marxist term. We don't think that, like, fucking social ills come from, like, a culture. Yeah. That's how fascists talk. They imply that there's, like, a fucking gypsy element in the community all of a sudden, and it's, like, making everyone think a certain way. And it's like, think about it. No, it's fucking, that is not, that's not how ideas work.
Yeah, it's almost as simple, not to bring it back to aging, but it's almost as simple as an aging problem, because it's like the public sphere changes with time. And it's just a matter of like, did you ever even like notice? Like, is that the privilege that you had that you never thought that it would change around you? It, you know, I think the generation war nonsense that is going on, even though I think it's so funny, is partially the same, is part of this thing too, because. Because of being online, because like in real life, nobody, there's no millennials fighting Gen Zs. You know what I mean? Like, it's only on TikTok and on Twitter. There's no fucking gangs of roving millennials battling, you know, like whatever. It's just online. And I think it's specifically because this kind of social environment, the online social environment, is the only place where you are forced to interact with the ideas of age groups that you normally would not hang out with. And it is striking for some people to see, oh shit, the young people think my hair is stupid. They're not, you know, we in New York, we make fun of like how scary teenagers are on the train because they will make fun of your outfit and shit like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, maybe the rest of you in the country need this check in your life.
Dude, it's literally, you know, that meme with Principal Skinner where he's like thinking for a second, and he goes, nah, the children are wrong. Like that's what it is.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just them being like, or even when you're shocked by what a boomer is like when it's funny, but when it's like, people acting shocked even at like American policy, you know, and like this kind of stuff. I'm like, it's only because you have only started engaging with like politics in last year, or you've only, so it's this like, it online forces you to have this like barrage of ideas coming from groups outside your own groups that give you feelings, man, unfortunately, that like hurt your feelings and make you mad. And it can be really funny, but then I'm also just wondering if it's like bad too. I don't know. Maybe we just need to go outside more. The spring is coming.
Yeah, definitely. Everyone is like hitting a boiling point with this isolation thing.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, those club owners. I fucking don't know how to do it. Let's. I don't know if we're gonna have time to talk about Patrice. We're gonna have to leave it for the other one, I think. But we could talk about this check spot thing.
Let's go and see what happens.
Yeah. Okay. So the check spot thing. So funny to me because, man, I'm not even going to name the comic because I don't think it's about her or anything like that. But like basically a comic out of nowhere just tweeted something where she said, you know, I think when the clubs reopen, it would be like a really nice gesture if they paid check spot comics $6 so that it would cover their train back and forth. They would really feel like they achieved something.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, it's like a nice sentiment. At face value, especially because of the fact that she's not doing check spots. So it's not like she was saying this for herself. You know, she's like showing concern. It's a form of not pulling the ladder up behind you, but like to a burning house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So then it's like, yeah, you're not helping me right now. You are really not helping me because you're just teaching them that, yeah, like, that you should expect even the minimum to just break even and be used for I hate it so much. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah,
so
no, man. I mean, yeah. I saw this shit happen, and it's like, I'm not mad at this comedian either. But I'm mad at comedians just in general because this is a, like, this person doesn't know. Like, these little people have formed a fucking culture that's so individualistic that they don't even understand how bad this is. Because, like, what? Okay. So
wait, we have to explain it because somebody did DM us on the show page to be like, hey, for the next episode, can you explain what a check spot is?
Okay, let's start at the beginning then.
Yeah, so let's start at the beginning. All right, a check spot, which I guess I could claim responsibility because I worked at this club, so I guess this is fucking partially my fault. I tried to get rid of this policy. It's one of the reasons that I quit. But they have check spots at some clubs, not all clubs, but I would say probably the majority of clubs, right? It's like, quote unquote, the good ones who have gotten rid of it. But the stand doesn't do a check spot. So see, that's how they claim to be good guys, because they do little things like this. But it's like such a, that's why the clubs that can't even do this, I'm like, it's such a tiny thing that you could do.
This is what happens when you have monopolies. Act like you
care about the art. Yes, exactly. But anyway, to go back to it. So a check spot is something that happens only in stand-up comedy. I don't think there's any other art form for which this happens during a performance. But when you go to a club that has check spots, they have a showcase lineup or even just a headliner, you know, opener mid setup or whatever, but they have a person scheduled who is called a check spot. And this person has a short-ish set that is unpaid that happens during usually the second to last spot, meaning right before the headliner or right before the last person on the showcase. And they call it the check spot because during that spot is when the wait staff drops the checks all around on all the tables all at once, right? So what ends up happening is, well, do you want to say as the comic what happens?
What?
Well, because I'll say, because what happens then is like, especially if you're like a Caroline's dude or like one of these giant ones, it's just like blah, 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 blah. You just hear like all the checks drop all at once around the entire room. So whoever's on stage, nobody's paying attention to you. Now there are rustling and purses and pockets looking for wallets and conversations about who's going to pay for what and people asking the waitress if they could still get one more round. Nobody is looking at the comic on stage. Okay. Yeah. Then the comic on stage has to somehow get better at comedy while nobody's looking at them, while their employer is not valuing their work,
right,
and while they are simultaneously teaching audiences, I am not important and this art form is not important. Go ahead and take care of your business with your waitress. And all of this is done under the guise of like they're supposedly giving you time to develop by giving you the worst fucking spot.
Right.
And then they're like, they're like, you're the least skilled, so we're going to put you on the most impossible spot. That makes fucking sense to us. But it obviously, Jake, can you tell I've been yelling a lot about check spots? I've been yelling about check spots for years. But obviously the reason that they put, so they frame it as though they put these comics on check spots as development spots. So they're trying to make you better. And then one day you'll earn your way to paid spots.
Yeah, it's stupid.
But in reality, they do it for two reasons. One reason is because a comic who values themselves will not do it, right? A comic who values themselves and who can get money is not going to work the spot at a club where every time they're going to drop checks during his fucking thing.
Yeah, and then open
it. Yeah, if they have clout or any of that, they're not going to do it. So that's why the club has to find somebody who will do it. And then second, it's because the club doesn't want to pay for security, right? Because basically, if the show ends and everybody gets off stage, now all the people in that dining room or whatever the fuck showroom can just get up and walk out, go to the bathroom, walk out the door, unless there's somebody at the door in a controlled exit getting, you know, like signed tickets or a token from the waitress or whatever the fuck indicating that they paid their tab. Clubs that don't want to or can't afford to pay for security to cover the shows use check spots so that way people think the show's not over yet. They get the check, they have to pay, then there's one more performer, then they get their fucking receipts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the whole thing is like the way they sell it, their, you know, a little fucking PR move here is that it's meritocratic, right? And so the idea that is that as a comedian, you work your way up from the hardest, you know, worst fucking spots, and then you know, 8 Mile happens and you have a miracle moment where you overcome that and now you're on your way to feature. And then when you fucking do better as a feature, then you're a fucking headliner and all this stuff.
And they love to throw the two names of two people who are doing well now who did check spots at their club.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Dan Soder did check spots. Look at him now.
It's like,
yeah, motherfucker. Hundreds. You did this to hundreds, if not thousands, of comics, and you can name one
that's
doing well.
It's like unpaid internship sort of stuff. And it doesn't make any sense, really, because, like, bad rooms make bad comics. Or no, they don't make bad comics. They make comics who are good at bad rooms, which is a specific type of comic, which is fine. Yeah. Like, I love that shit. When I first started doing comedy, I used to ask to go up at the end of the open mic because I just, like, loved, like, fucking with a room that had that energy in it.
Yeah.
And, like, had this weird kind of inside-out thing going on. But, like, I'm a specific type of comic, you know? I mean, can you imagine, like, if there's, like, a Stephen Wright out there in your scene and the only way to get into being booked is doing the fucking check spot? That person will never get past that. And they're funnier than everybody else who's doing the check spots in a specific way, right? So, like, it structurally it makes no sense. Two arguments against working this way are, like, you know, I think we talked about this before, but, like, take, like, Larry David. Like, that guy, like, lived in, like, artist housing forever and then, like, had, like, just space to work. He wasn't thrown into this, like, you know, meritocratic machinery. And then also, like, the way they do it a lot of the times, or I think they used to do it in, like, Canada and, like, in the old, like, lounge scenes and stuff like that, is, like, they didn't do, like, the order that we have where, like, the host is the worst comic and the newest comic. It was the host would be like, Rodney Dangerfield's show was like this. He's the main guy. He would come out and host the show, and then every set he'd be like, make some noise, you know, once he's got the crowd going, you're gonna love this next person. I fucking love this next person. And then he brings in a new person, but they're coming in with, like, room to work and stuff, and then you kind of move from there, you know. If you bomb, it's kind of on you, you know.
Yeah.
And there's no argument against this. There's no argument that, like, it works better with the check spot way or whatever. The other thing about the check spots is, like, okay, so just personally, in my experience, what happened with me with this club that we're talking about is they emailed me. I fucking never worked their club, and they emailed me and asked me if I wanted to start doing these things. So
I mean, they have my contact list, basically, because I work there. So, you know, as a booker, when you work for a club, you get all of their contacts that previously were booked at that club, but they also, because you have to put your people into the system, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So then they also get all of yours. So basically, Amy Hawthorne was also the booker of Stand Up New York for like 5 days before I was. So I also have Amy's contact list. So this is that's the value of bookers that you pass around. So they hire you for a little while to get your contact list. And then I believe that after I left, they had the bartender there became the next booker.
Yeah.
And she took my contact list. And part of the reason that I had originally been hired was because I was going to be for them the bridge into, like, the alt world, right? For them to get new talent and be relevant amongst young comics again and all of this stuff. But then, because, like, that's the only reason I went there, because they told me they wanted to change, right? And then when I tried to change it, they were like, no, wait, but not that much. I'm like, no, wait, no. But I left, and then they just had the bartender use my contact list to, like, reach out to comics for check spots, I hear now, so that they could see you and see if you were good and decide. But as far as I know, they kept booking all of their regulars for the paid spots.
But yeah, I mean, look at the fucking lineup. Like, who is it, right?
Yeah, it's still just always the same guys.
So they emailed me. From my point of view, what happens is a club emails me and they're like, do you want to do check spots? And I'm like, okay, well, this is the audition spot, right? This must move to fucking paying work. So I'm booking out my week or whatever, my spots and stuff.
Yeah.
And I kept doing spots at this club and they were going pretty well. At least, you know, from my point of view, I'm the person. I could be wrong about that or whatever. But, like, eventually somebody asked, because they had booked a bunch of new people, I guess because of your fucking Rolodex or whatever. And somebody was like, hey, how does this fucking, you know, how do I get paid? Like, how do I move up? What's the criteria? Because I'm having good check spots and, like, nothing's happening. And they sent out an email and they were like, oh, just so everyone knows, like, we don't move anyone up unless they have 2 TV credits. And then so I immediately was like, oh, well,
why'd you call me?
Why would I work for you for free then? Because the thing is, I'm not going to get, it's not connected to, I'm not going to get TV spots out of doing check spots at your club. You're telling me to leave and come back. And what you've been doing is taking advantage of, like, fucking naivete.
Yeah.
Because, like, you just, why would you even tell me that? Like, continue to lie to me.
No, it's completely just taking advantage. The seller does not do check spots. And, like, they do last call while the show's still happening, but they don't drop checks until after the last comic. Or, you know, if it's, like, one of those things where, like you said, like, a headliner's hosting their own thing or whatever, and they're talking mad shit at the end, they'll drop checks during their thing.
Yeah.
You know? But what they do is, you know, I'm not, this is not to say that I'm a fan of this system, but at least the seller recognizes that that's bullshit, that the check spot system is bullshit, and they do an audition system. So they call people in to see them perform and then decide if they're going to get paid spots. But at least they're not doing something where they're calling somebody in, making them perform, and then being like, oh, but you don't have the qualifications anyway to get paid here. Like, yeah. Why would you do that? Why would you do that? Yeah. So it doesn't fucking make sense. You just wanted somebody to work, especially Jake, when it's like, that club is a nightmare and people just cancel and like they know that it's not going to be a show. Like, comics know that it's not going to be a good show there. So if they could pick up a spot literally anywhere else, they will make Stand Up New York move there. They're fucking like, they'll be like, oh, can I go later, whatever, and it fucking stinks. And so when you lose the check spot because they got an actual paid spot somewhere, or they have a better alt show to go to or whatever, they would have to scramble to see who they could get to do the check spot, and that's when they would pick up these kids who would hang out outside all day, like waiting to see if they could get a spot.
I know this fucking
and it's like, they're never going to consider you for paid spots.
Yeah, you're getting ripped off. And it's your own fault on some level, you know? Yeah. And so, like, let's talk about that for a little bit. Cause, like, you know, yeah, I'm not going to throw anyone.
Oh, that's what I wanted to talk about. Yes. Let's talk about that, the scab part of things.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to throw anyone under the bus because I don't think people freaking really understand, but I want them to understand. This is what I'm talking about. Like, so this person
I agree.
That said, hey, how about $6, you need to be suspicious if you ask your boss for something and they give it to you like smilingly, like they're you are in a power struggle with your boss by nature, so getting stuff from them should be a power struggle, but if they're happy about it, that means they got more out of it than you did, right? And so this is a situation where I think the fucking club owner here went, wait a minute, oh, we'll look really good, this is like good PR, and it's only gonna cost us fucking $6 a show, right? And that it's a business, so it makes fucking surplus money off the top. So they're like, oh, that's perfect. Now we can use this to lord over the other people. Because that's like the fucking PR move here. Is this guy's been like fucking like martyring himself and saying like, oh, we're so nice. So what's funny about that is that $6 for transportation is, you remember like back in the 70s
that's
or whatever?
That's what I was going to bring up.
Yeah, yeah.
This is right out of Mitzi's fucking playbook, baby.
Yeah, when they were fucking striking at the Comedy Store in the 1970s when Jay Leno was an open micer or whatever, this is what they got from their boss. They got fucking $6 in 1972.
And it was specifically for cab fare. And both in the 70s and Danny on this fucking Twitter machine did the exact same rationalization of like, I am insisting that this is called transportation pay, not spot pay, because A, they don't want to set the precedent of this is a paid spot.
Yeah.
And B, there were literally comics who were responding to the club people being like, oh, well, I didn't get paid when we did check spots. What's going on? You guys getting soft? So you're fucking a bunch of assholes. Like, the fact that there's a bunch of comics who actually think, I went through this, you should have to too. Whether or not you ended up getting paid spots, whether or not you ended up getting TV credits from this process, why the fuck would you uphold it? How does it benefit you? It doesn't make for a good show. It doesn't make for respect of your industry. It doesn't make for developing good new talent that's going to be on shows with you in the future. It doesn't make for valuing, like, it's part of the reason your fucking spot pay doesn't go up, idiots. If they start giving $20 to the check spot, you can argue then the professionals should get more money, right?
Right.
Think about it. Use your fucking brain.
Well, like, the thing is, in order to think about this, like, okay, so another thing that happened that fucking really bothered me, and I think this person listens to the show, so I'm sorry, I just disagree with you. I'm going to explain why. I'm not hating here, right? Is that somebody responded to the initial comic who raised the fucking check spot question and was like, man, I think they were probably joking or whatever. They were like, you're fucking head of the comics union now, right? And I'm like a nerd about this sort of stuff, so I'm like, no, you need to understand that, like, what a union is specifically functions in a way. Like, collective action is not one person going, can I have $6? It's the only way we could actually engage in the power struggle with our fucking boss is if we collectively sort of all went, hey, we're all going to pull out at the same time if you don't give us what we think is our fair share of the money, which is more than fucking $6. That would not happen with one person who is friends with the boss performatively going like, hey, I have an idea that'll make us all look good and it'll throw breadcrumbs at the fucking workers, right? Yeah. But in order to understand that, like, you have to treat this like this person is your enemy, which they are, but you're the fucking comedians have this like entrepreneurial goddamn Andrew Yang ass mindset where they're like, no, 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 the fucking, you know, the owner's my friend. And since I'm going to be in the headliner circle someday, I it's going to be me and him versus everyone else, not me and everyone else versus him.
Temporarily embarrassed headliners.
Yes, that's exactly what they are. And like,
I would say it's also this like family shit, dude, that's like toxic, you know. A lot of the toxic ideas behind a family of just like, you forgive each other and there might be bad things and whatever, but we help each other ultimately, get like projected onto the way that the relationships go between comics and club owners, I think very specifically because they have a brick and mortar place that comics can congregate around and associate with and all this stuff, but also with other kinds of industry where it's like, they are looking for a maternal or paternal kind of relationship of like, you do things for me because you love me because of my talent. And until I can prove to you that I deserve that love, then I'll do other things to get you to look at my talent.
It's sick. It's like a ward system or something weird like that. And like, what's also the other thing about it is if you're a comic and you're listening to this, listen to me. It's short-sighted because the thing is, this person uses their monopoly of power to, you know, put you through this little ringer, and they joke, like they joked, the fucking club owner joked to this fucking person. They said like, well, you know, you used to be in check spot hell, but you're doing great now, right? And it's like, yeah. I'm asking you to do free advertisement for the fact that this check spot thing is good. You literally, you created this thing that you were referring to as hell. What the fuck is that? Like, you should just be creating a good situation, right? You, that's you telling us that you understand that this is a fucking system that exploits the person, right? And so, like, you engaging
well,
with that?
I do think that that club person is also a performer. And I think that that's a particular kind of scab that also is different, you know, like not to be a dick to this person in particular, because there's a lot of them, but there's something that's exactly the same about, like, you know, when somebody said that the person who did the original tweet, like, oh, you should be in the union or you're the union rep for comedy.
Yeah.
My immediate thought was like, no, she's like HR for clubs.
Right. Yeah.
Or PR for clubs. Like, I don't know what to tell you. That's not the right thing. And I think that this fucking thing is another version of that. The
This is what I was going to say, is that like, you're short-sighted if you're looking at it this way and you're buying into the system, because the immediate thing that they're dangling in front of you is like, oh yeah, you're going to get these working gigs, right? And you're going to make a certain amount of money, and they have a certain monopoly over like stage time and audiences and stuff like that, and they can get you in with the fucking networks and stuff like that. But that stuff is left over from like the 90s. This guy accused me of burning a bridge with him, or he's like, the bridge is burned. Like, he tried to hold it over me, like he had power over me. Like, oh, you could have worked here and you burned the bridge. But I told him, like, my experience with you was that you weren't worth it for me. And he kept talking about me and trying to box me out by saying like, well, why don't you just get funnier? Why don't you work harder? And then you'll get into my club. I've seen the people at Worker Club. This is the fucking argument number one against this is a meritocratic situation. You just book dumbasses that you're friends with. It's not based on some objective robot that goes, oh, who's even the best at playing this room. You know, it's just fucking your homies. So you're just using this as a manipulative tactic. But like, the thing is, if you just...
Sorry to the funny comics who still do spots of stand-up New York.
I'm sure there are fucking plenty of them, but there's also some bad ones. And that leads me to think that like, hey, maybe capitalism isn't a system that just rewards artists who are the best artists, right? It rewards people for making better connections. The other thing is, You have all the tools in the world to make your own shit right now. You're not in the 80s. You're just participating in a cult that's based in the 80s, that was structured in the 80s. I don't work stand-up New York because I don't fucking need to, because I book my own shit that pays better than it would pay to fucking work that place, unless you're talking, like, really long, long, long game. I mean, if you become, like, one of the fucking 1% of people that, you know, happens to work clubs like that as a headliner sometimes, which will usually happen because you got successful outside of that fucking place. But, you know, if you want to maintain the relationship by being a scab all the time, I guess go that way. But you don't need to. You can just book your own fucking shit. And, like, these people are, they're wielding a power that is imaginary over you. They're taking advantage of the fact think the only way to do comedy is to use their stool and their microphone. Makes no fucking sense.
And it's not just that, though. It's like the shortcut mentality, because this is what I was going to say about the performer turned industry, right? Turned club manager or any of that, is everybody, a lot of people in comedy, especially a long time, like in the 90s and shit. And so that's why it's weird that some of these fucking strategies have still survived, as though it's like good traditions. But when comics do bringers, I think it's the same thing as, and I don't mean like perform on bringers, I mean run bringers, right? Because there are several comics who are on TV now and shit who started by doing bringers. There are some who started by doing check spots, or some who started by being a club manager or working in a club in another way. But the people who did bringers, and I think if you're booking comics for your check spots, you're the equivalent of a bringer. They were looking for a shortcut to getting stage time, right? Which was, if I run my own show and I charge comics to perform on it, then I get stage time and I also make money, and then I become successful, and then people want me to, like, they want to network with me to get on my show to get stage time. I move up, right?
Yeah.
But there's no, like, acknowledgement of the fact that what you're doing when you do these strategies is literally stepping on other people to get ahead. You know what I mean? Like, they think that it's like honorable and good, and doing check spots is the same thing, or like being a comic who books comics to do check spots is the same thing. You're trying to move forward yourself by putting comics in literally what you call a hell spot, right? And instead there's this, what you were saying, of like, go out there and make your own shows and do your own thing. If what you really want to do is perform, then, hey, honestly, do either one. Make your own shows or do check spots, because whatever, you don't care. You just want to perform, right? Although we just told you check spots are going to be annoying spots. But if what you want to do is make money, like, why are you doing check spots? It is not ultimately, like you said, it's short-sighted, but it's like a short-sighted view of a fucking long-ass plan. Like, that is not going to make you money for literally years, if ever.
Yeah. Yeah. And, anyway, and part of the reason it's not going to make you any money is because we only have enough power as individuals to get $6 out of these people. But if you don't act like that, if you have collective fucking power, you can get more out of them. And I think something that's really important to understand about, like, the reason I kept bringing up, like, this guy kept saying, oh, you burned a bridge here, is because the way that makes this kind of more apparent, I think, to look at it, and as to why I'm being so fucking dismissive of this guy, is that I value my own work and my own power more than I think these comedians do who roll over for these guys. And from my point of view, I told this guy, you burned a bridge with me. Like, think about that, because, like, I don't need you. And you're talking to me like I fucking need you. And if enough of us go, hey, you need us for your club, suddenly you'll realize, like, oh, I can withhold my part of the deal. Because when you make a, when you like work with a booker like this, you're making a deal with them. You're not working, like, they're not your friend. Like, you're, it's quid pro quo, right? And if you withhold your part of the deal in a powerful enough way, you can get them on some level to raise their spot pay. Like,
but the problem is the scab problem, Jake.
I know. And it's like,
fact, and I don't mean, wait.
Fine.
I don't think it's just, I don't mean it just as like, oh, you're all scabs. I mean the fear of the scab. Every comic also has internalized the idea that if I don't take this spot, somebody else will. So it doesn't even enter your mind to think, like, how can we collectively get them to pay us more? Because
I know it's functionally impossible with the culture of comedians. And also, you know, you're not workers. Like, this stuff works if you're workers and you're essential, but like, you're not. You're actually buying a comedy career. Like, you're the customer in a lot of ways. So this doesn't fucking work. But, you know, this is a small scene. I mean, there's a fucking 100 headliner Rich Voss fucking, you know, Jim Norton dickheads walking around who, like, if you convince them of this, suddenly these people wouldn't have a pool of talent to book from, which is where they actually kind of scrape off all their surplus value. And that's the problem. I think you could overcome this by convincing those fucking 100 people of this, but you know, they don't fucking care because they already got theirs. So like,
yeah, exactly. Because look at, that's what I mean. It's like, if there is a not TV accredited comic fucking basically vouching for the check spot system, if you get $6, how are we ever going to even expect a fucking millionaire comic to give a shit about not working this club when they're in New York? You know, like, I don't know. It's tough. I hope, my hope, and part of why we do the show, I think, is because I am interested in having conversations with my friends and people I don't know about how you do your art. Like, think about these things instead of thinking that it's like a roadmap that's provided to you that you have to walk down and hit all these markers and do all these things the way it's always been done, and then use every possible shortcut to get up that list as quickly as possible. You might actually A, enjoy yourself, and B, find some kind of success. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't know. But unless, did you have something else to say about check spots? Because I have something else to say about club owners.
Nah, go for it.
I was just going to tell you, you should stop talking to them. No, I'm serious. I've been thinking about this a lot because, Jake, they only talk to you for clout, dude. They both, so far, they had small accounts. They definitely got more followers because of messing with you. You reply to them, and as much as they do get hate, and some of them block, like, I saw Chris locked his account. that they do still, like, you know, it's they're virtue signaling. They are signaling to a certain type of comic that they're on the side of being anti-cancel culture and anti-Jake and anti-Seth Simons and anti-fucking Me Too and anti-anything that's asking us to give a shit about anybody but ourselves and our jokes. And you should just not give them a platform anymore, dude. They are not worth your time. They're, let them... I mean, I just hope their businesses go out of business, is all I can say.
Yeah, I mean, I know what you mean, but, like, you know, Chris Italia locked his account, and Danny What's-His-Face stopped talking to me after I'm giving myself too much credit, but he asked me a question about, like, how I should run his, you know, business or whatever, and I told him I run my own business, I pay my workers, here's how I fucking do it, and he stopped talking to me. So I think that I might have publicly made him look bad. I could be wrong about that, but I do think that, like, on some level... Like, someone has to fucking say this in public to these people, and they're picking me in public because they don't think that I will make them look bad, but, like...
I know. I think you're right. And, like, look, this is why I say the things that I say, and I say them on this podcast, or I tweet them, or honestly, I say them in conversation, and their little fan base and that, like, toxic male kind of shit, they like to believe this idea... They're debate me people, right? They like to believe this idea that if you're brave or whatever, you would say shit directly to people and you would get in a fucking fight with them and whatever. And they also believe that if anybody says anything that you disagree with, they owe you a debate. And you know what? That's not the fucking way the world works. I don't owe anybody a fucking debate. I can talk about my experiences. I don't give a fuck. I'll say it here right now. I don't know if I told you. Oh, I think I told you when we were drinking that Danny texted me in the middle of fighting with you on Twitter.
Yeah.
Texted me to ask me, because I guess somebody listened to this podcast and fucking told that I was saying shit about working at Stand Up New York. And he texted me to be like, hey, I know that I can't tell you what to talk about, but... Can you please explain to me why you would talk about private business like the liquor license thing? I didn't even reply, Jake. You know why? Because I don't owe you a fucking explanation. I'm an adult person who has the right to have an opinion about the interactions that I've had, the observations that I've made, the people I've met in my life. I understand that if I say something publicly, it might get back to the person that I said it. I will never deny the words that I said, but I don't owe you shit. I don't owe you an explanation. I said what I said because I fucking meant it. It is what it is. If I had a regret, I would go to you and I would apologize. It's not that it's not going to happen. So I'm not even going to engage because, you know, I guess sometimes you should engage, right? Because maybe they can hear you and because maybe they need this different voice happening in their circle. But then there are other times when they're dead set. Look at Italia, when I kept trying to be reasonable with him about the fact that he was gaslighting both of us. He just kept replying over and over, Luisa, I will always be your friend. I don't know what you're saying. I will always be your friend. What kind of fucking gaslighting, manipulative bullshit is that?
He shuts down.
There's no dialogue there. That's not a conversation. I'm not going to convince him that he's wrong. He's not going to change his mind and publicly realize that none of that is going to happen. So I'm not going to waste my mental health, my whatever platform I have, my emotional space. It's just not fucking worth it, dude. Let this loser go off into his fucking check spot obscurity and book whoever the fuck he wants. And whoever asks us about where to go for comedy in New York is not going to hear that name.
Right, sure. But I think, like, I don't think it's about convincing these guys because the currency that they're dealing with here is, like, reputation. It's like clout.
Yeah.
They're not engaging with us because they think they're going to change our minds either. They're trying to perform to other people that, you know, they're right and we're wrong. And I think that they fucking get got sometimes. And like, and I say this because, like, you know, you remember when fucking Big J wanted to come on this show and like he was talking to you and stuff. And at one point, you know, it's like he's got this whole fucking podcast and the whole thing is like, we say whatever we want and fucking everything's jokes. You know, you can joke about anything or whatever. And then eventually he gets frustrated and he goes like, well, you know, he's arguing with like, we shouldn't be able to say the stuff we're saying. And he's like, well, it's making other people not like me. And you, for a moment, you go, oh, you just showed your weakness there. This is what you're actually concerned about because this actually affects you. So you don't actually believe everything is okay to say or whatever, yada, yada. This is like actually something that hurts you, right? That's what's going on, I think, with these club owners where they're like, they're taking a risk where they're trying to gain like a reputation off of like, I'm going to go own fucking Jake Flores or Seth Simons or whatever. But the thing is, the reason I say this is like, it's probably why I'm a comic and fucking you're not or whatever. Like, I feel compelled to do this stuff and like I don't really feel compelled to censor myself. And I do people DM
I'm
me.
I'm an anthropologist. I'm compelled to write a book about that.
Dude, I talk to people in private and they go, keep doing this. Like, thank you for fucking doing this. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back or anything, but like that happens. It happened to me fucking yesterday when I was talking to somebody. And like everybody fucking hates these people, but nobody feels like safe criticizing them. But I do because I built a platform outside of the fucking clubs. So if anybody feels this way, but they're stuck in check spot hell, they can't tell this motherfucker this shit. And they also can't do it publicly enough to where like enough like famous comedians and stuff that watch this shit will see it and then change their opinion and then actually put some pressure on this guy to maybe change the way he does things. That's why I'm doing it. But it's also driving me insane, so I'm going to take this into account.
Yeah, no, and I understand. I guess I'm in direct action, gal. I believe in the conversation should be happening and the information should be publicized and people should speak their mind. I just don't think that it needs to be, especially, you know, like an initial interaction is fine, but I even responded to Chris too many times. I was like, why am I even still typing the same thing into this fucking thing for no reason? Like, it's just, I don't know. Like, maybe we both, I try to learn that balance of like, from you getting more involved, I guess. And maybe from me, you need to take some of my Gen X side of like, sometimes you just gotta fucking walk away.
I mean, that is the millennial versus Gen X thing for sure. Because I'm like, totally. I'm an idiot who thinks that I can change the world, you know?
Whereas I have no problem. Like, I will go to any of these clubs when they reopen if I feel like it. And I will go in and I'll say hi to the comics I like and I'll ignore whoever. Like, I don't care. I don't give a shit. You can be mad. Like, they could come up to me to my face and I will be like, damn, dude, this is not the time or place. I'm moving on. And just like walk away. Why would I have these arguments? But as a matter of fact, part of the reason that I speak the way that I do is because I've already decided that I don't want to be associated with you. I don't want to maintain a friendship with you. I don't want to be in your circle. I don't see it as my responsibility to fix you. I hate that I was ever associated with you. So I'm done. And then I am able to say whatever the fuck I want because I'm a terrible person. I don't know. Like, I don't know what to tell you. I think it's fine. I said the things, like, especially it would be different if I was like super nice or like, I am nice, dude. I mean, if I was like not genuine with them when they knew me, but literally both Chris and Danny, this is who I've always been. It's part of why you liked me, motherfuckers. Well, and then as soon as I have some criticism for you that you are not willing to back down on, then I'm now part of the enemy, right? So, fine.
I know we don't have time to talk.
You can't call me an enemy and also be like, why are you talking about me?
Yeah. Like,
make up your mind,
motherfuckers. Well, it's fucking performative. They want to perform that they are cool with you because you're industry and you're on their side and they're fucking heads in this. You know, it's also, like, we don't have time to talk about the fucking Patrice documentary because we went off with this whole thing. We'll have to do it, like, next time or whatever. But, like, you know, I was watching that documentary about Patrice O'Neal and shit. And, like, he is an iconoclast within this fucking world. And all these people after he's dead are saying, I loved that so much about him. He challenged everyone around him. It's like, but you demonstrably don't when people do it right now at you. You know?
Yeah.
So, like.
But that's because they're part of the establishment now. They just don't want to admit that. You know what I mean? Like, they were able to admire Patrice being anti-establishment and anti-business because they came in at the same time as him. So it was like, wow, admirable that he made these brave, courageous, original choices while they were following the fucking little brick road of what you're supposed to do to be a famous stand-up. But now they did become famous stand-ups. Every person in that documentary, with the exception, I mean, I'm not saying they're not famous, but the women are all nice people. I don't want to say anything bad about them. The dudes, though, questionable. Although Robert Kelly has like one of my favorite jokes ever on earth, but you know, people change. But they are now all part of the establishment of comedy. And like I will say to you, Robert Kelly straight up, I don't know if this is like a mean thing to say, but he's threatened by young comics. You know, like I think he's even like vocalized the fact that he recognizes that when he sees a young comic who's funny, that's somebody who's coming for your spot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So they are already like poised to protect the status quo because the status quo is what gave them their position. So of course they're not going to like people who are now being like, don't do check spots, clubs are bad, fucking don't rape women, you know, like all this stuff. So, but it's crazy because they thought they were iconoclasts when they were younger and they never noticed that they turned into the opposite.
Yeah. Like a bunch of fucking boomers.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what they are. No. Oh, no, they're not. They're Gen X, right? Mostly.
It's funny because the entire documentary is like Patrice is like not compromising for, you know, jobs, which is the thing that they have all justified. Yeah. And it's like people are like simultaneously saying like, I think that's so cool that he did that. But, you know, then kind of out the other side of their mouth going like, oh, but it was a business mistake and he shouldn't have. But I think it's so cool. It's like you can't cash in on the clout of the truth and being right and at the same time act like you think a better idea is to be pragmatic and throw people under the bus around you, you know?
Yeah. Let's leave it because I think we could do an hour on this Patrice documentary.
Yeah. Okay, let's do it next week.
Yeah, next week. Unless we have a guest. We'll see. But other than that, some pluggies. PDA. Well, I'll let you do your full PDA. Mine is just I did some podcasts this last 2 weeks. I don't know. Google it. I did a Library Punks and...
You did Kenzo's.
And late night show with... who's?
You did Kenzo's thing, right? Stream.
Not yet. No, it's I'm doing that in 2 weeks, I think. Yeah, Meet the Left, which, oh my God, so cool to do, but I totally am having imposter syndrome. I don't know if it's like what's happening, but I'm like, oh my God, it's like with real organizers and people who really help society instead of being obsessed with artists.
It's also just like internet people. Like
I know, exactly. But, you know, I'm prepared to defend the fact that I'm like the cultural propaganda a wing of the leftist movement. I am here to make sure that the artists understand the correct propaganda that they should be selling to make our ideology spread. Watch, they're totally going to clip that and fucking act like that's really my goal. I was just kidding, for the record. But anyway, yeah, and I'll be on Kenzo's thing, Meet the Left, in a couple of weeks. I'll tweet about that. And then, yeah, write us emails. I don't think we're going to have time to do a mailbag or anything today, but we'll see. Maybe.
Yeah, probably not. I don't know. Sorry. We had to take a work vacation, but we'll be back soon.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry about that. Anything you wanted to plug or anything, Jake?
Just fucking PDA and I guess Twitch and merch and whatever. I don't know. I should be, this looks like I could be back on the road by the end of the year. I don't know. Keep an eye out for that. You know, comedy might come back soon.
Yeah, I'm already in talks to start a couple of shows, Jake. I don't know. I was so sure I was going to quit, but then, like, I don't know.
We'll see. Yeah, you can't.
I will. No, please.
It's in your blood, man.
I don't want to. But also, it does feel partly like I will not cede ground. Like,
shouldn't.
Like, we can't just let these fucking club owners keep owning this shit. Like, I don't know, man.
No, it's fucking goddamn tragedy that they survived this pandemic and it's just gonna stay this way.
I know it is a tragedy, but good luck to everybody that moved to Austin. I really am looking forward to the new comedy that will come out of New York. It's gonna be amazing.
God, there's so much funny shit about, we didn't even get to the fucking club owner, Danny. Like, did you read that story about the janitor he fired and shit?
Yes.
Oh, God.
Oh, he told this sweet, heartwarming story about how he loved going to that club with his friend or some shit. And he was friends with the janitor who let them in for free. And then he grew up and he made money and he bought the club and he fired the janitor.
He's like, what? He wasn't doing his job right.
Yeah. Oh my god. Ugh. I'm like, why'd you bring it up then, guys?
This,
like,
dude, okay, this is the other reason I engage with these motherfuckers, is like, that is objectively hilarious. Like, I'm not just fucking fighting a war here. I think it's very funny.
Yeah, dude. It is. That's pretty much why I will probably still show my face at their clubs, because I think it's objectively funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to just be like, hey man, what's up? Who's on the lineup?
All right. All right, let's fucking end the podcast.
Bye everybody, get the fuck out of here.